For the Pacifica Radio Network and Planet Waves FM, welcome to The Miracle Hour. My name is Eric Francis Coppolino, broadcasting from Kingston, New York. This is our little Sunday school for A Course in Miracles, the seminal work of the New Age that is equally sought out, avoided, and probably a few other things. Mainly because of what I perceive as a language issue. The Course in Miracles history of creation of the thing is well documented and will be the topic of future programs. However, it was what we call in contemporary times, I guess, channeled, meaning that an author heard an inner kind of inner dictation that was not, that she didn't recognize as being part of herself, except in some spiritual sense, some deeper self, and wrote it down, and what was coming through this channeling, this sort of inspired writing, I guess if you can hear the skepticism in my voice, but that's how the story goes. And what was coming through this inspired writing came through in the first person as the voice of Jesus. Now, normally, I personally wouldn't pay all that much attention to it, but it came into my life. Course in Miracles came into my life at a time when I needed help. First of all, needed some orientation on a spiritual path, being in a time of massive transition and crisis. That coming at the time of graduating from university, and also notably my first Chiron square. Chiron square, Chiron, that's an astrology topic, but I was born in the 1960s, and everyone born in the 1960s at around age 22 went through this this event. The Chiron square gets progressively earlier as people born into the 70s and 80s are born, and then it starts to get progressively later. But the thing is that, especially for a young adult, it can be a really critical time when it happens, and that's what it was for me, and I was indeed in transition and definitely in crisis, and so I started reading this thing, and there's this little hump you have to get over in terms of the male-dominated gender language and then the Christian references to God, right? So it's God, Jesus, Holy Spirit, Father, Son, all this stuff. And if you have humanist or feminist leanings, and you know, like your language to be as gender neutral as possible, or if you're female, you have to either get over that or not, you know, deal with the materials and get the information in some other form. So this one reason why that here in this series of programs we're doing a critical reading, and we're addressing the issue of the gender in the language. Though I think that it really isn't about actual maleness or sonness versus daughterness. I think those are the words that are used, and they were typical language of their time. You know, the 1960s, when this was put together, people were still referring to, you know, humanity as man. Nobody would say that now, you know, in the life of man, referring to, you know, women, children, transgendered people, and all this, we would say the life of people. So language has come a good distance in these approximately 50 years since this project began. Actually, it begins in September of 1965, is when a person called Helen Schuckman at the Columbia University School of Physicians and Surgeons Department of Medical Psychology, of all places, starts to get this material following a series of what seemed like visionary dreams. And her boss, this guy, Dr. William Thetford, who I guess was the chairman of, chairman, right? I do prefer that word to chairperson. But anyway, chairman of medical psychology at Columbia University School of Physicians and Surgeons, right? So these were medical psychologists working in a medical school. They were scientists. And to be involved in a kind of a bringing in of some new testament or gospel, which this material for all the world sounds like, kind of a modern gospel, it was in their world crazy. So they're pulling the blinds and closing the curtains and meeting early every morning, and Helen is reading aloud from stenopads where she's transcribed back in the day when assistant to the department head with a PhD also sat and took steno dictation, so she knew shorthand, and so that's how she was able to write all this down in her distinctive style of shorthand. And then she'd come in, they'd meet up in the morning, pull the curtains, and Bill would type what she had written. And this whole manuscript is available. That's one of the places that we'll be going, is to look at what's called the UR manuscript, the unrevised manuscript. The Course in Miracles edition that I'm working with is an adaptation of the second edition. The second edition is what became published, and that was the thing you'd send away $20 for to Tiburon, California, and get your three sets of books. And finally, that was taken over, I think, by Viking or someone, and re-typeset. And that edition is the one with all the paragraphs and sentences numbered. That keys into a huge concordance, in case you are the document junkie for this stuff, and you want to track things against a concordance that's about maybe like 4 inches thick. It's quite a amazing project. So the concordance keys into the what's called the second edition with the numbers on the paragraphs and sentences, in case you really want to map everything out. There is, by the way, an older concordance that came out in the 80s that's a cool book because it's not an attempt to be thorough. Rather, it is just a lot of great quotes organized basically by topic. So anyway, this work appears, and it shows up, and it sells a lot of copies and translated into a lot of languages. I don't really meet too many people who have gone too far with it, or who will admit to going too far with it. But I think most people who associate, with spiritual bookstores and so forth have heard of it. Everyone's heard of Marianne Williamson, who bases her work on the course. She is probably the most popular kind of republisher, reinterpreter of the work. And anyway, that's a little background. Now, I was in my friendly neighborhood used bookshop, where I spend a fair amount of time. I am a bibliophile. I like to collect and read books, both, and I think that books are important, and books are a missing piece of our civilization right now. I could give a long talk about Marshall McLuhan's media theory in books, but I do advocate the use of books as a way to get to know yourself. And one of those book thingies was handed to me by Jessica, the owner of Half Moon Books next to Blue Studio in friendly uptown Kingston, New York. And the book is The Religious Case Against Belief by James P. Carse. I have not read the book, but I've read bits of it. And I did what I always do with books or tarot cards or horoscopes. Well, I pick at random. With horoscope, I jump right to Pisces, my own sign, and see what it says. And that's all. If you're a horoscope author, that's all you get. If I like Pisces, I'll keep reading. And if I don't, I will probably never read it again. In any event, bibliomancy is one of my favorite things to do, which is to pick up a book and flip it open and see where it lands. And so I did that with The Religious Case Against Belief. And I opened up to a paragraph on page 132. But then I just turned, this was a couple of weeks ago, and I turned back to the precursor paragraph to that, and I think I'll read that to you, and let's just see let's see what this author has to say and contemplate it for a second and move on from that. Okay, so James P. Carse writes, "It seems, therefore, that the image of the quest," in quotes, "for the real Jesus, the idea that we can go somewhere to find him, has been reversed. Far from trying to get closer to him, are we moving outward along with a scattered community of other searchers? Far from trying to get closer to him, we are moving outward along with a scattered community of other searchers. Whoever this person was, whatever he did the final year of his short life, there is enough power there to set off a tsunami of ignorance. What does it mean to, quote, believe, unquote, in Jesus, or to believe that Jesus was God, or to believe that he was not God, or that he was anything else? It means, at the very least, that we have to hide from ourselves how much we don't know. We have to call in our selected Jesus and close the door against the clamorous horde of alternative Jesuses, or Jesi, as my friend Johnny Asia says, surrounding our enclosure. But the roar won't diminish. No matter how successfully we deafen ourselves and suppress our curiosity, the excluded voices are always there to be heard by those who can't hear. Not all voices are equal, of course. Some will rise above the others, drawing in a larger audience, even requiring their own exposition, deepening the wonder of the mystery of the man. It is in this sense that vast literature about Jesus is about nothing except itself, and therefore ultimately says nothing. There is no possibility of standing back and declaring, ah, so this is what it's all about. To do so is only to join the clamor. It is to be taken over by the poetry of it all. Okay, here's where I opened up to. Next paragraph. Jesus is not the only person around whom a cloud of ignorance forms. The names of the others are quite familiar. Indeed, the degree of their familiarity is an indication of the depth of our ignorance about them. We know a great deal, and yet nothing, about the Buddha. When will we ever get exactly the right understanding of Moses, Muhammad, Shankara, or Lao Tzu? Or, coming closer, when will the final word be written on Shakespeare, by far the most written about figure in all of human history, literary figure in all of human history, or Lincoln, the most written about figure in American history? New paragraph. It's just as true about all of it is just as true about all of these as it is about Jesus that their interpreters have not completely understood them. The more that is learned, the more the range of the unknown extends. The inability to settle on a final reading of any of them is not a matter of being historically or intellectually inaccurate. I'll read that again. The inability to settle on a final reading of any of them is not a matter of being historically or intellectually inaccurate. When interpreters claim certainty, they declare they have the real, quote, Jesus, and the, quote, true teachings of Muhammad. They are not making a factual, but a religious mistake. And then he asks, why religious? What, after all, is religion? And then he goes on. We may return to this. This is gutsy theological writing, I think. I was very happy to read this. I personally, in my own work as a teacher, avoid belief and suggest to people go beyond their beliefs, go deeper than belief. Belief is fragile, and as James P. Carse is writing here, as far as I can see, belief covers a lack of knowledge. It throws a scrim over a level of ignorance, and then everything's cool because you believe something and you can recognize people who are also believers, and then everyone feels better about themselves because they all believe the same thing. But really, do you know anything when you believe something? So I think this is why, as part of one's individual personal spiritual path, it is excellent to question belief and to find something better. Now, I can see where Karras is going with his argument. Where he's going is that ultimately religion is about forming an inner connection, religios, to reconnect with inner spirit, with spirit. Now, obviously, we're not going to find spirit out there. Always, the finding of spirit is always a transition, I think, not to use a too extreme of a word like always, but it involves us. It's not really about something out there in the world. This is not the search for the preposterous hippopotamus who you can actually find drinking at his purple watering hole. No, the search for spirit is something about me. It's something about you in your search for your inner spirit. And this is where the dogma, the doctrine of this is the true spirituality, this is the thing to believe and you'll have it right, is a ruse. But I think that the last thing he says is kind of funny, in that he's saying it's not a historical inaccuracy or factual inaccuracy to claim that you know the real deal. He's saying that it's a religious issue as well. I would say it's definitely a historical issue and a factual issue, but let's just set that aside for the sake of Karras's proposition here. He's saying the real problem in thinking you know the truth, everybody else is wrong, is a religious issue. And especially if that truth is something that you have adopted from the outside, that the quest is an inner quest to be closer to, quote, Jesus. It's just to be closer to the loving part of yourself, your what you might think of as your core self, who presumably is this loving entity. Now, this could be challenged. We could say, well, what about Charles Manson? He has long hair and a beard. Is he on the quest for his inner Jesus? But that's a kind of a theological cone. I think for the purposes of, garden variety seekers such as you and me, the thing to remember is that this is an inner quest. And what is so appealing about A Course in Miracles as a religious document, let's call it that, because that's kind of on its face, that's what it is. It's about making that religios, that connection. What is so appealing about it is that it is so guided inwardly and entirely directed at the experience of perception, at the experience of what one feels, what one sees, what one experiences, and designed to connect with something not external but internal. And so here we have, I think, the real point of curiosity. It's not written like a bunch of dry, theological, press board. It's actually pretty interesting to read, particularly because it's so oriented at one's own inner psychology and learning about one's inner psychology. But further, it's not written in a bunch of conflicting and cryptic parables where it is exceedingly difficult using these parables to actually, in our contemporary world, to make much sense out of them. And I think that the kind of modern story that A Course in Miracles is aimed at and intended to address is the story we tell ourselves about our psychology. All right, let's take a little music break. And this is from Vision Quest. I haven't picked out the music yet, so I don't know what I'm going to play here, but I'm going to play something from the Vision Quest collection. And then when we come back, let's talk about this sort of addendum to A Course in Miracles called the Clarification of Terms. Editions of our program, I have gone over the main volumes of Course in Miracles. Second program I devoted to the textbook, second to the workbook, both cursory overviews, but still introduced the subject. Third program last week, Manual for Teachers. And I mentioned this kind of interesting maneuver of including a teaching manual in a book for beginning students. That's kind of interesting, right? Because it sends the message straight away that you will be teaching or you are teaching. And one of the main theories of Course in Miracles is that everyone teaches and teaches all the time, which means that our example is always an example for others. But more to the point, our example of action is always intended to teach ourselves. And so one of the kind of clever turns of psychology that the course is offering is that you teach what it is that you want to be true, and therefore it's best to choose what you want to teach based on what you want to be true. Now, this sounds terribly unscientific, but actually science kind of works this way too, because science is often about calling the witness that whoever needs science needs that witness to say. But really, I think we are teaching ourselves as we go through the day and, in a sense, proving what it is that we want to be true. So I read this last week, and I'm going to reread this passage, or at least some of it. So there are these three main volumes of A Course in Miracles: text, workbook, teacher's manual. And then at the end of the teacher's manual, there is a kind of what was considered an addendum, kind of a fourth portion, not technically part of the teacher's manual, but it's stuck in the same book, so it actually is. And it was clarification of terms, and then to that was added an epilogue, and then there is another volume called Psychotherapy, Purpose, Process, and Practice, another supplement. So we'll look at those soon. So this, I think, speaks to Carse's idea that to speculate and then call that factually accurate is misguided. So here's the introduction to the clarification of terms. This is not a course in philosophical speculation, nor is it concerned with precise terminology. It is concerned only with atonement, or the correction of perception. And when you see atonement, you can also think of at one ment with yourself. The means of the atonement is forgiveness. So this is actually the thing that you do to get the results that you want. By the way, I've seen this. I've had some kind of exciting miracles happen from my own attempts to actually be forgiving and to let go of grievances, and then amazing things can happen. So Further reading, the structure of the individual consciousness is irrelevant, essentially irrelevant because it is a concept representing the original error or original sin. To study the error itself does not lead to correction. If you were indeed to succeed in overlooking the error. And it's just this process of overlooking at which the course aims. And I think this is probably worth reading. Then we'll move on to the words that we're talking about. All terms are potentially controversial, and those who seek controversy will find it, and those who seek clarification will find it as well. They must, however, be willing to overlook controversy, remembering that it is a defense against truth in the form of a delaying maneuver. By the way, it's worth looking at any controversy you see in the world and asking yourself, is this merely a delaying maneuver? Reading further, theological considerations as such are necessarily controversial since they depend on belief and can therefore be accepted or rejected. A universal theology is impossible, but a universal experience is not only possible, but necessary. And I think what they're talking about is just basically being friendly, being loving. It is this experience toward which the course is directed. Here alone, consistency becomes possible, and here alone, uncertainty ends. So the emphasis is on direct experience, not about accepting an idea, which is why it's not necessary to accept the ideas in A Course in Miracles as true. It's only necessary to experiment with them and see what you get. I consider that honest spirituality. It's kind of like when Alice Bailey, in what may be the strangest astrology book ever written, called Esoteric Astrology, which came out around 1950, says, look, don't believe me. Just try this out for a couple of years. 3 years, she says. Look at charts from this viewpoint and see what you get. If you like it, great. If you don't like it, forget about it. Okay, so in that spirit, the first term clarified is mind-spirit, mind-spirit. So the distinction between these two words. By the way, I've always found that the teacher's manual to be one of the more challenging bits of philosophy in The Course in Miracles, but you know, we'll see. And I'm back here reviewing the material for my once every 30-year review. Okay, the term mind is used to represent the activating agent of spirit supplying its creative energy. When the term is capitalized, it refers to God or Christ, i.e. the mind of God or the mind of Christ, visualize the capitals. Spirit is the thought of God which he created like himself. The unified spirit is God's one son or child or Christ. Okay. To me, this actually makes some sense. That might make it scarier. Okay. So, mind, let's just read it again slowly, sticking to the text for a second. Mind is used to represent the activating agent of spirit, supplying its creative energy. Consciousness, right? We don't know where consciousness comes from. You may be able to say that your body is made of stardust and the earth came when the sun was cooling and planets formed and there was some primordial ooze and lightning struck the pond and then amoebas came and then monkeys came and then we came. That may be perfectly true or not, but it doesn't tell you where your consciousness is coming from right now. That is a huge, colossal mystery. And I think it's one of the most meaningful, important, beautiful, positively stunning mystical spiritual mysteries, which is, where is your consciousness coming from? How is it that you are able to perceive the world around you with such incredible detail and have such an influence on it. So, mind is the activating agent of spirit. It's kind of like described here as a catalyst. Sorry, my voice is a little bit froggy this morning, and I'm going to be teaching astrology, tarot, for 3 hours later. When the term is capitalized, it refers to God or Christ, the mind of God, or the mind of Christ. So there's kind of like the oversoul, this central mind through which all minds are joined. Spirit is the thought of God, which he created like himself. Okay, so here's the basic, skipping the terminology for a second, this explains some of the basic kind of mechanics of how the Course in Miracles is proposing that our minds are organized. Using its own terminology, God extended himself and into time and space. And time and space respond, and we show up, containing that original thought. In other words, even though we may seem separate and like we want to break our neighbor's window because they're screaming, yelling at night and smoking 14 packs of cigarettes a day, our mind still contains the original thought that created us. You don't need A Course in Miracles to experiment with that idea. This is the essence of many, many spiritual teachings. Not all spiritual teachings, but the essence of many spiritual teachings, particularly in the Christian era, that the what I think is the relatively simple message of Jesus is that you contain, you are what I am, basically. Let's pretend this guy who people think is the Messiah comes along, and his basic message is, you have what I have, whatever you think I have. You think I'm the child of God? Okay, that's you. Only skipping the Bible story, it may work. You have to test it yourself to find out that you contain the original living thought, memory of God connected to the big one. And this is what the Bible is talking about when it mentions the Holy Spirit. It's what the Course in Miracles is talking about when it mentions the Holy Spirit. And so from what you might think of as a metaphysical viewpoint, again, taking this all as metaphor, but as a description of kind of where we fit the whole scene, that the role of Jesus, Christ, meaning christened one, but also meaning kind of like an organizing principle, was to make us aware that we contain God within us. And that God in that form is the Holy Spirit. Actually does, in my experience, respond to being called by that name. So these names are important only in as much as you can use them to identify things that are actually real to you. I have two dog friends I live with. One is called Jonah and one is called Henrietta. And they know their names and I know their names, and it's all good. So when you're thinking, what is this inner thing? Give it a name. Could be Shekinah. There are other names for this, and I personally have observed this may be what we think of as the feminine aspect, the inner, physically, emotionally experienced aspect of universal consciousness, experienced inwardly as both personal and transpersonal, right? So you can dial in this thing. It's suddenly like being able to get on the internet and get help when you need it. And the most, I think, hilarious miracles have happened to me when I have done that and something has responded. There was a, well, we'll see what this story reveals. But I was living in Brussels about maybe 9 years ago and 10 years ago, and really reached a low point in my life, a moment of complete and total frustration, like really something like I had never felt before. It was really a dark moment of the soul. And my phone rang right then, and it was a spiritual teacher I had not heard from in years. Somehow got my number in Brussels. I haven't the faintest idea how, and my phone rang, and I was in a state of need, and really, I was in some trouble in that moment. I don't think anything especially bad would have happened, but instead of something bad happening, I got a phone call and brought myself back into reality with the help of someone. How that transpersonal communication happened, I don't know, but I've seen it happen hundreds of times personally, and my own observation is that there is indeed some what we would think of as spiritual force operating that is accessed through individual consciousness, but is far beyond individual consciousness. Of Course in Miracles emphasizes this over and over again and describes it over and over again. And then the lessons, the Course in Miracles workbook lessons, are intended to put you in contact with that thing. So you don't need to believe the lesson. You only need to kind of do what it suggests. Close your eyes. Imagine you're descending into the light inside of you. Well, things like that. Innocent enough. I'm very suspicious of culty BS and religious BS. This seems perfectly innocuous. To imagine that you contain light and are descending into that light within yourself. Ah, okay, this is practice. There's 365 of these lessons, and they're all basically designed the same thing, to do the same thing. Get the kind of block of perception out of the way and make contact with the light within. And then once you've learned how to do this dependably, and you have practice at it, you don't need the Course in Miracles anymore. You then put this into practice. And while you're doing workbook lessons, you're also putting it into practice. Practice leads to more accomplishment. And so when, for example, you're dealing with any person in pain, you can just prompt yourself to establish contact with that thing inside you, that living thought, that memory of God, that is a living, active connection to the greater metropolitan cosmos beyond yourself. And now you're not acting on your own power. If you're helping, assisting someone, if you're called upon, you walk down the street, you come in, you're confronted by a crisis, or you're in your own home and you're confronted by some form of a crisis. The phone rings and you're confronted by some form of a crisis. You are a healer of some kind. You work as a massage therapist or tarot card reader, and you're confronted by a crisis, which you do a lot of as a tarot card reader and massage therapist, and heck, as a nurse or medical doctor. You have a way to seek assistance that is not of the documented normal physical form of assistance. You're tapping into something that you contain, that you can request the help of as a gesture of sort of getting out of your own way, and then you proceed to do whatever it is that you think you need to do. Only you've asked for help. That is a big difference. And that asking for help, in my experience, goes a long way. I would not want to do the work that I do, writing horoscopes read by sometimes millions of people, without knowing that I had, for example, connected all of my astrological work, quote-unquote astrological work, is this another language, astrological work to this inner source. One of the cool things the Course in Miracles says a few times is you depend too much on your own strength. tap into some deeper strength. Now, Gestalt therapy would say, ah, yeah, but that's you too. And that's fine. A Course in Miracles would agree that that is you too. But that leads us to the next paragraph. We've only gone about 50 words into the clarification of terms. In this world, reads clarification of terms, because the mind is split, the sons of God, us, children of God, appear to be separate. Nor do their minds seem to be joined. In this illusory state, the concept of, quote, an individual mind, quote, quote, seems to be meaningful. It is therefore described in the Course as if it has two parts, spirit and ego. Righto. We're cooking with gas. Spirit is the part that still is in contact with God through the Holy Spirit, who abides in this part but sees the other part as well. Interesting. Okay, let's take that sentence. I've personally can attest to the personal truth of this. Spirit is the part that is still in contact with God through the Holy Spirit, who abides in this part, the spirit part of the mind, but sees the other part, that is to say, the ego, this kind of false identity made of fear and separation, as well. So this identity called the Holy Spirit actually can deal with, see, process, recognize that there is a kind of a mistake, which is believing that you're made of fear and guilt and pain. That is probably not true. It could be very convincing, but we're looking at an alternative here. Okay. The term soul is not used except in direct biblical quotations because of its highly controversial nature. It would, however, be an equivalent of spirit with the understanding that being part of God, it is eternal and was never born. Soul is a great subject, and we can come back to it. I think soul is more of a process than a thing. Soul is the process of making contact with spirit. The other part of the mind is essentially illusory and makes only illusions. That's what the Course calls the ego. Spirit retains the potential for creating, but its will, which is God's will, seems to be imprisoned while the mind is not unified. Creation continues unabated because that is the will of God. This will is always unified and therefore has no meaning in this world. It has no opposite and no degrees. And on that note, let's listen to a little more music from Vision Quest. And I'll think about what I'm going to say next or not. Here's some music.
Thank you.
So, this last sentence slipped into this paragraph is worth, I think, reading again. So I'll read it again. This will, creation continues unabated, even when the mind is split and there's controversy, chaos, and struggle. Creation continues unabated because that is the will of God. Here's the sentence. This will is always unified and therefore has no meaning in this world. It has no opposite and no degrees. This is really interesting to me. Anyway, I think one of the implications is that only things that have opposites and degrees and are therefore made of contrast and made of controversy seem interesting in our world. True enough. Till you really tuned in, and then more sublime things like, you know, what's the opposite of beautiful music? Well, you know, is there one? This will is always unified and therefore has no meaning in this world. It has no opposite and no degrees. It simply is there. Further reading. The mind can be right or wrong, depending on the voice to which it listens. Right-mindedness, in italics, so this is a term of art here from A Course in Miracles, listens to the Holy Spirit, forgives the world, and through Christ's vision, sees the real world in its place. So this is about learning how to see the world from the viewpoint of the part of the mind that is still connected with God. This is the quest. This is, if there's a quest, this is the one. If there's a learning journey, I think this is a pretty good one. I'm signed on for this one. Okay, so we'll read this again. Right-mindedness listens to the Holy Spirit, forgives the world, and through Christ's vision sees the world, the real world, in its place. This is the final vision, the last perception, the condition in which God takes the final step himself. Here, time and illusions end together. A lot in the Course is about perception of time. Wrong-mindedness listens to the ego and makes illusions. That is to say, wrong-mindedness, in italics, listens to fear and guilt. That's the ego. You can, whenever you see the words "the ego" in A Course in Miracles, you don't need to think of it as a thing you can kind of put in a box or a jar. It is a thought form made of fear and guilt. The ego makes illusions, perceiving sin and justifying anger, and seeing guilt, disease, and death as real. Both this world and the real world are illusions because right-mindedness merely overlooks or forgives what never happened. Therefore, it is not the one-mindedness of the Christ mind whose will is one with God's. But that, this is me adding, that would seem to be where this is all headed. In this world, the only remaining freedom is the freedom of choice. Always between two choices or two voices, will is not involved in perception at any level, nor has anything to do with choice. Not sure I understand that. Consciousness is the receptive mechanism, receiving messages from above or below, from the Holy Spirit or from the ego, from ego consciousness, from the ego, missing period. Consciousness has levels, and awareness can shift quite dramatically, but it cannot transcend the perceptual realm. At its highest, consciousness becomes aware of the real world, the world of love, in this framework, and can be trained to do so increasingly. Yet this, the very fact that it has levels and can be trained, demonstrates that it cannot reach knowledge. Okay, so knowledge, the word knowledge needs a little thing here in the clarification of terms. It is there. Okay, great. That's number four. We're not going to have time for that today. But they're onto this. The editors and the whoever the central intelligence thing dictating this thing to Helen, if such existed, have defined. Knowledge is kind of a, well, let's leave that blank. It's not easy to kind of convey that into words, but let's read that sentence again, because it's kind of cool. Two sentences. At its highest, consciousness becomes aware of the real world and can be trained to do so increasingly. Yet the fact that it, consciousness, has levels and can be trained demonstrates that it cannot reach knowledge. Let's just say that knowledge is something else that is beyond what we're talking about here, but is somehow accessible, and we will get to that. This has been fun. There's a lot in reading carefully. I'm very happy to have put so much time into learning how to read carefully. I learned a lot of it from reading A Course in Miracles, because I read the thing, you know, with the with a journalistic and editor's eye, even though I was, let's say, suspending disbelief. Kind of like when you're reading fiction, you don't say to yourself, these people are all characters, this town doesn't really exist, and this author made all this up. You'd say to yourself, I'm going to read a book. And you read. So with A Course in Miracles, I did both. I suspended disbelief, but I also read with paying attention. I didn't quite pick it apart like I'm doing now, sentence by sentence three times, but read it carefully enough to at least understand what the author was getting at. I think that's a very important level of reading, is to read to the degree where you have an understanding of the point of the writing, not what you think it's supposed to mean, as much as you can get away from that, to submit yourself to grasping the idea. Most of what happens in reading is it either goes by like a movie and we forget that there's anything much happening, or many people when reading are like really concerned about whether they agree or disagree with something. And if they agree, it's good. If they disagree, it's bad. And I'm suggesting here that being able to shift your viewpoint into the viewpoint of another person or piece of writing is helpful, in that it helps you, first of all, practice the mobility of consciousness. And it helps you get out of your own reference framework so that you can take on board another reference framework. Now, I think this may be scary for lots of folks, because you think, well, if I even hypothetically accept that other reference framework, I'm going to completely lose what I've got and all that. That's fear, and you're not that fragile. I learned how to do this, interestingly, the first time, or right around when I was getting the hang of this. I was 19 years old, and I was on my first really big assignment as a journalist. A story I discovered, an assignment I gave myself and got approved by my editors, but it involved going to the Love Canal neighborhood in Niagara Falls, New York, a neighborhood formerly with a school in the middle of it that was built on a massive nuclear and chemical waste dump. If you can believe such a thing happens, it actually happens a lot. And I figured out what I was doing, which I was sitting there with this state official, this dude from the Love Canal Area Revitalization Agency, this BS state agency that was basically a real estate developer designed to sell toxic houses back to people. And I wasn't fooled, but I sat there in the office, in this converted home in Love Canal, Niagara Falls, New York. This is around 83. And I let the guy convince me he was right. I completely submitted myself to the viewpoint that it was just fine to sell people to paint the homes over, change the names of the streets, and then sell them to people cheap. You got a four-bedroom home for $50,000. Wow, that's nice. Too bad about all the toxic waste in the backyard. And it was through doing that that I discovered a reporting technique, which is to do exactly that. Let the person convince me. I'm not so afraid that someone's going to mislead me. And I figure if I can let someone convince me of something, I can let them convince me of something else. And I played it like a little game. And it's similar with taking on board the work of any author, any writer, any viewpoint. Listen for a while and see if you can actually slip in to the viewpoint of the presenter. Now, you need reality checks to do this. You need to check your thinking and go back over it a few times, possibly check with other people's perception. But I think with A Course in Miracles, it does help just to figure out where it's coming from and then ask yourself if that works for you. All right, that's all our time for today. You can reach me on the internet at planetwaves.net or planetwaves.fm. All the programs in this series are archived at planetwaves.fm, including other fun materials on those pages. Don't miss the interview with Kenneth Wapnick. We'll include that on this program's page at planetwaves.fm. You can reach me at efc@ericfrancis.com. If I don't reply, just send your email again. Sometimes I get kind of busy, like often, and I would be very happy to hear from you. For Pacifica Radio Network and Planet Waves FM, my name is Eric Francis Coppolino. This has been the fifth edition of The Miracle Hour. It's been fabulous to be with you, and I'll catch you on a different day. Bye for now.